Like, which one do you want to settle for? Do you want to be middle-aged? You know? Like, I guess I'm a 30-something. Maybe I'm not quite middle-aged. I don't know when middle ages starts. I think it's around 40 or something, so I'm not quite there. So I guess I'm a 30-something, right? But is that who I am? Like, do I go around fulfilling expectations of a 30-something? It's like I have a, what is it? I think it's a 2005 VW station wagon. But you say to me, who are you? And I don't say, well, I'm a VW station wagon. But for some reason, people identify with their sort of physical body, or their psychological body, or their astral body, don't they? Right? So it's like, if I don't pick body, should I pick personality? Like, I'm somebody on the path. That's a good one to be. I'm a curious person. I'm curious about the future. Or, I'm a responsible person. Or, I'm kind of lazy. Well, I'm kind of wild. Right? I'm working on myself. Right? These are all different psychological takes on oneself. So each plane, each turn of the dial has a different statement of your identity, and each one is getting into a more and more profound place. So when we come back to the who am I, it's almost like you have to further that question by saying, well, on which channel? Because if you start at the top and work your way down through the sort of grosser planes, it's like, I am the void who manifests as the one, who becomes the many, who has a unique set of factors to work out through a unique astral, psychological, and physical body. And that's what I'm doing on Earth. Like, I've taken a body to do certain work. And when I finish that work, I will drop that body. So what we're dealing with here are the issues of karma and reincarnation. And, you know, maybe we'll take some more time with concepts like that another day, but I'm trying to lay them out in a sort of, in as selfish of a way as I can, in as human of a way as I can. And these concepts, by the way, were totally normal concepts until the sort of first 5 centuries after Christ. In these councils, Christian councils of Nicaea, Constantinople, and a third one I don't remember the name of, but these ideas were roughly thrown out of Christianity. Because they didn't make the church a workable situation, right? Because when you had reincarnation and karma, every human being was their own priest. It was just between you and God. So for the church to keep its own control and see its function as seeing people living moral, proper lives, it had to get rid of those concepts. But we should know that those were absolutely normal, everyday concepts. Karma and reincarnation were everyday concepts to early Christians. So, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, have I taken birth before? Well, it's like, I don't have any experiential knowledge of that. But from this perspective, undoubtedly thousands and thousands of times. Right? So what if you saw it all from this point of view? You know, what if you could just imagine what it's like to see your life as so functional to your awakening? And even your death, equally so. That the whole business becomes a process of growth and awakening and deepening and clearing and shifting channels. And there's no problem about transition. There's no holding on out of fear. There's just opening. Right? Ramana Maharishi was dying of cancer, and he had great miraculous powers. I'm pretty sure I told you about the great story of him sneaking a note into his diaper and astral traveling, but it's a story for another day. But he had great sort of guru powers, miracle powers. And when he was dying, his devotees said to him, "Bhagavan, just heal yourself. Right? You have these powers, stay alive." And he said, "No, this body's used up." And they said, "Don't leave us, Bhagavan." And they started to cry. "Don't leave us." And he said to them, "Don't be silly. Right? Where could I go? Where could I go?" That's like me saying, you know, I'm selling my Volkswagen, and you saying, "Don't leave, don't leave." It's like, well, I'm not leaving. I'm just selling my Volkswagen, right? So could you imagine seeing death from that point of view? I've watched a few family members go through the kind of slow hospital death. And I've traveled and performed in homes for the dying in various countries, and seen this strange thing happens sometimes where the doctor comes into the room and says, "Wow, you're looking better." And then they go into the hallway and say, you know, "She won't live through the night." Right? Call the family. And it's like from the doctors to the nurses to the sisters to the sons and the relatives, the ministers, the priests and the rabbis, like there's this fear of death, like throughout the entire organization. It's like they're so frightened of death that there's this surrounding denial of the process, which leaves the person at the moment that they need most to be able to share what's happening to them. It leaves them with a total void of that kind of honesty, of compassion. And I'm sure most of you have probably seen those kind of situations, and many of us have totally participated in them because we were not knowing quite what else we could do. And the hospice movement has done an incredible amount of work on this level, right? Focusing on attending to the comfort of the patient, attending to their emotional and their spiritual needs, right, as they approach the end of life. In India, it's pretty different, man, because it's right out in front of you, right? Death is really, it's not hidden in any way, right? Sometimes when somebody dies, they'll wrap them in a sheet and put them in a little rickshaw and, you know, literally parade them down the street to the burning ghat. And you'll see, like, you'll be just walking along and you'll see a dead being in a rickshaw just clacking down the street, and everyone sort of salutes as he goes by, right? As opposed to what we have here, which is kind of the minute somebody dies, they disappear, right? Their body is sort of taken away, and maybe, you know, if you're close enough family, you can have a very brief opportunity to view the body before it's embalmed and preserved and made up to look alive. Dressed in its best outfit and encased in sort of a structure which is designed to keep decay out. You know, it's like the sheet goes over the person and the whole thing is covered up, like, in denial of death just like starts immediately. So you know, hospice and many people out there are doing a great deal just by training people to be good listeners, right? And be able to psychologically kind of hang out with people who are dying. And that takes a lot of courage. Yeah, I remember in Sumatra on a social circus project, I found myself. We went to perform in a home for the dying near I can't remember the name of the town, somewhere in kind of urban Sumatra, and we're in this great big home with I don't know, maybe somewhere between 50 and 100 guests, and all in various states of disease and aging, and they were very grateful for the show we performed, and the little nun that was running the place asked us, well, there's many patients here that can't get out of bed. I wonder if you'd be interested in going to visit them in their rooms. Because they would love to see the show, but my performance partner and I started clowning our way through the hallways and sticking our heads in on guests and kind of playing the Patch Adams game, I guess you could call it. I found myself face to face with this Indonesian woman who is lying in bed and going through such incredible agony I wasn't even sure if she recognized. She had the strongest expression of pain I've ever seen on her face, and you know, on that kind of level, sometimes you are just working on instinct, you know. And I remember pulling the clown nose off, and just sitting down next to her bed and holding her hand, and just being there, right? Just being absolutely present with her. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, maybe the reason, you know, watching her kind of go through the anguish of her physical situation, but feeling the squeeze of her hand and feeling how that pain would ebb, you know, it would fall like every wave crests and falls, and something about that human contact and that presence, right? Not trying to make the pain go away, not feeding her more drugs, or even trying to distract her from the pain, just holding her hand and being there through the pain, right? It just seemed to improve both of our moods, I'll just say that. I remember thinking to myself, wow, maybe the reason why I came on this big tour with many, many shows had nothing to do with the performance itself, but actually this little moment of holding this old woman's hand. So, what if you went even further out than that? What if you said, I would like to use my death as a vehicle for awakening? Like the process of dying could be a vehicle to waking up. And, you know, you gotta understand that the tradition of seeing the process of dying that way is probably understood by more people in the world today than there are who don't understand it. You know, we're talking about India, China, Japan, like all the Eastern countries, more or less can see it this way. And for such a person, you know, one could sit down with that person and just be very, very straight. You know, like you get the fear right out in the open. So if this, you know, what if this dying relative just shines all their fears on you? And what comes back is just peace, right? Not denial, right? Not peace like, oh, it'll be fine. And not subject changing, which is something that we constantly do when we're faced with disease or illness that we're not sort of ready to be around, right? But what if it was just peace that we shine back, right? Like if we saw dying as this opportunity to leave behind what you thought you were. Not what you are, but what you thought you were. And so it's like they would run through all this fear and they'd get back peace. Again and again and again. And this isn't you trying to change them, right? It's not you trying to change their perception. It's like you're just being you and you're working on yourself in front of them and you're being present and you're being real and you're just watching them slowly open and let go of identifying with the body and identifying with the pain and finding this spaciousness in which they can see death, right? They can see the link between birth and death and the cycle between, you know, a father changing his son's diaper and then the son changing his father's diaper. Right? Seeing that cycle and seeing that growth that can come from that. Right? So if you want to be useful to people who are dying, it could be quite simple, right? You work on yourself. You don't work on the other person. You know, you help them where they need help, of course, but we have this model that's so deeply ingrained in us, right, as teachers and as healers, right, that we're healing someone else. We're doing it for them, you know, like we're improving their lives, right? But usually, I mean, to be totally frank and totally honest, like, I'm just trying to work on myself. Like, if I could find a job where I would learn as much as I learn teaching yoga, I would just as easily do that other job. I mean, I've chosen this line of work because I'm 100% engrossed in my own awakening, and this is quite simply the best excuse I could come up with for studying it, right? And if that's useful for other people, then great. And so if you were to be around a dying person, a dying being, maybe you could just offer them your own being, your own growth, right? Like every moment of your life, once you understand the purpose of it, every moment of your life is your vehicle for your awakening. So this moment is the vehicle for your awakening. This moment, right now. And if you're uncomfortable at this moment, okay, you're uncomfortable. Allow it. If you're fascinated at this moment, be fascinated. Allow it. Right? Give it space. You know, it's like that difference. If you're looking at a picture of a cloud and the image fills up the frames with just cloud, pure white cloud, so all there is puffy white, then that's your whole reality. But if you zoom the image out a bit, you see the edges of the cloud and you see the blue sky around the cloud, and then you see the sky, and then you understand better what the cloud is. And that's the difference of being engrossed, overwhelmed, and identifying with your emotion versus seeing it with some context. It's the difference between saying, I am depressed, versus, wow, look at that depression. Like, wow, I wonder if I'll ever get through that one. You see, like I'm showing in that second one, how it's possible to have a sense of humor, even about your depression, right? It's like if you've got a sense of humor, how depressed could you be? Right? But that's the issue. That's the issue about that tiny bit of spaciousness that surrounds the experiences of life. You know, it's like I if I'm hungry and I'm going down the street, I'm going to notice restaurants. And if my car is on E and there's a beeping noise coming out of the dashboard, then I'm going to notice gas stations, right? Like, my universe will be full of what my mind is full of. And you and I and everyone are living in entirely different universes, because every individual is kind of living in this, in their universe, selecting from the possible infinity of things. And those things which kind of lock in with your own desires, right? So if you identify with a desire, that's going to determine what you see in the world. But when you get to the point where you can allow a desire without identifying it, without identifying with it, right? Like, sure, I have lust. And sure, I have greed. And sure, I have depression. But here I am. Yeah. So somebody could say to you, you know, are you sad? And you could say, sure. Yeah, there's a little sadness there. And in the same breath, they could say, are you happy? You could say, yeah, you know, I am. There's some happiness there. And you could say, are you getting older? And you could say, yeah. Absolutely. Right? There's an aging body. But I am, right? No matter what the description is, well, yes, and I am. And that's because, you know, you're starting to live on these different channels, all of them, all at once. And from this place, from this multi-channel perspective, you start to have these great beings who can face enormous upheaval with gigantic smiles. And I don't know about you, but that's something that really excites me. You know, none of these people, from Jesus to Ramana Maharishi to Mother Teresa to Hafez to the Dalai Lama to Martin Luther King Jr., none of them have taught that their way was impossible for us. That world, that kind of steadiness that some of these great beings have demonstrated, that love, that heart, they're totally within reach. We just need to have the courage to reach out and grab it. So, with just a few minutes left, maybe we'll take a little time for a short meditation.